This podcast is a copyrighted production of Radio America and is not intended for broadcast.
The United States Army Air Force is off for Berlin.
Ready for war, sir. Ready for war.
The magnificence of the courage and fortitude of the Korean people defies description.
Other battles were raging in the streets of Saigon.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
There has been unusual American air activity in the area of the Persian Gulf.
We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential.
Afghanistan is a war that we had to fight and we have to win.
This is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join our honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
To the present day.
In Afghanistan and Iraq, 50 million people are now living in freedom.
Now, the American Veterans Center and Radio America present Veterans Chronicles.
Welcome to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus, and I'm joined this week by our very special guest, retired U.S. Army Brigadier General John Doc Bonson, who's also the author of American Warrior. It's an account of his two tours of duty in Vietnam, and it's amazing how much he packed into two tours in Vietnam. We'll be talking about his career with gunships and the different extraction missions that he had, taking out different Viet Cong positions. It's an amazing story, and we'll begin where it should begin with his formative years. But first of all, sir, General, thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's start at the best point to begin, and that's your dream from a very young age to go to West Point and be in the U.S. Army. Where did that dream begin?
Well, it began with my father. My father was a reserve officer and back in the 30s and was commander of a CCC camp, which was a big thing then. He was an honored graduate of Riverside Military Academy and, of course, got a commission after going to high school there. And his father refused to send him to college. But in spite of that, he got a commission as a second lieutenant, rose to the rank of first lieutenant, commanded a CCC camp, and served for about a year on active duty as a CCC camp commander. And then they relieved him of his duties, which was the way they did things back that time for reserve officers. And he resented the treatment he got by being a reserve. And he later on was civilian commander of CCC camp. But he says, when our sons get old enough, they're going to be regular Army officers. I don't give a damn what. And he set out as his goal in life to have his two sons, my brother and I, to go to get a reserve, we'd be regular Army officers. And so from the time, again, I can remember, I was going to go to West Point, and which I was tickled with. And, of course, during the 40s, if you remember, World War II was on. And, of course, Doc Blanchard and Glenn Davis played football there, and everybody knew about that. Basically, we wanted to be soldiers. He wanted us to be a soldier. He wanted us to be regular Army officers because he'd been treated so poorly as a reservist. And basically, he lived to see his dream to get us to West Point. Of course, I couldn't wait to go. And, of course, he sent us off to prep school, went to Marion Institute, Marion Military Institute, to get prepped, which I needed. And I might add the reason I got into West Point is because I went over there and took the classes. They had a prep course at that time, and they still have that prep course. And they usually had a great success rate. And my brother followed 2 years behind me, did the same thing, and both of us went into West Point 2 years apart. I loved every minute of it. And, of course, I tell people I wanted to be a soldier. I enjoyed hunting. I enjoyed the outdoors. We rode horseback. As I say, we had a great upbringing in South Georgia, and the farm country down in, around Rochelle, Georgia. And I wanted to be a soldier. From about the time I was not this big, I wanted to be a soldier. And I played war, and I did competitive sports and games and everything else, but enjoyed thinking about being a soldier. But going to West Point was, you know, kind of the culmination of the dreams of a young man wanting to go off and be a soldier. And my dad, of course, wanted me to be a regular Army officer. That's his whole aim. He talked about that endlessly. You know, about being a regular. They can't throw you out when you're a regular. Well, he's right about part of it because that's changed since that time. But that's the background as a youngster, and I never regretted a day of it. I loved every single minute of my 30 years in the Army, plus the 4 years at West Point. I looked forward every morning to get up and going to work and be with soldiers, and I enjoyed it. I make no bones about it. There are some days better than others, but as I look back on it, I have nothing but good memories of it. The sad memories have to do with the soldiers that served under my command that were wounded or killed in action. And of course, that's sad when you have any of that happen to you. And so that's support you don't like. But as far as my relationship, the Army is made up of people. And if you like soldiers and you like being around people that are dedicated and patriotic, then it's a perfect occupation to have. Of course, the friendships I made at West Point, they're still good today, as you know. So, you know, here we are, we graduated in 1956, but we met each other in 1952. So 52, we met as 17, 18-year-olds, and most of us remain friends. Those who are still surviving in our class are very close friends. They're my closest friends in the world, my West Point classmates. And so that's generally the background of why I went to West Point and the fact that I loved every minute of it.
Your original assignment for what you were supposed to be flying over there did not exactly thrill you.
I had to go to school to learn how to fly a Caribou, which I hated. And luckily for me, I went to work for a lieutenant colonel who, as soon as I walked in and told him I want to be a gunship pilot, he says, oh, I'm my kind of guy. And as he shook my hand and we talked, I said, sir, I don't want to spend a day in a Caribou. He says, don't you worry. I've got a job for you. He says, you want to command a gunship platoon? I'm going to get you in a gunship platoon. He made damn sure I got a gunship platoon and I could lead a platoon in combat. Now, I have to admit I was a little bit overqualified, having been an 11th graduate and commanding a platoon, because I'd already commanded a tank platoon and a tank company. But basically, that platoon leader leadership, which was where I got cut my teeth, gave me the basic, my bona fides, I call them, to go out and be a combat leader, because you led from the front and you set the example on a daily basis. And so being a gunship pilot happened mainly because I had a great lieutenant colonel that gave me the job. And I might add, I never flew a Caribou ever again. But being a gunship leader, I learned the fundamentals of warfare. And, of course, our mission was to shoot people and to protect the slick aircraft, the helicopters. And so I had a good tour as a platoon leader on my first tour, and then later on was an operations officer of a lift company, which was also a good assignment. I worked for some great people. And that beginning in combat, working with those good people and having a job which I could identify with, leadership, and basically platoon leaders lead, and they lead by example. You know, I was able to validate my understanding of leadership, which is set the example. Number one of all the things you do is set the example.
You were determined to be a soldier, and you knew what the job entailed in terms, especially in wartime, of having to kill people, the enemy. Most people, their idea of that is very different when they actually have to do it. For you, it seemed like a seamless transition. Was it just you had a deeper understanding than most going into it, or is it just
develop it. But let me tell you, my attitude is very simple. We're going to fight the enemy. The enemy of my country is my enemy, and our mission was to kill them. You could capture them if you could. We captured a lot of them in my units, but we killed them. And my feeling was that's our job. I was probably as well-trained as anybody you'd ever find. When I went to war in Vietnam, when I was assigned there, I'd had great assignments. I'd been an instructor at armor school. I'd commanded a company. I'd commanded a platoon. I had great training. I'd also been a teacher of artillery FOs, forward observers. And so I was proficient in everything. I was an expert in all my weapons. I was proficient with artillery fire. I was a pilot, so I knew how to adjust fighter strikes. I went as highly qualified as you can get, and I was full of beans, ready to go do it. You know, extraordinary testosterone, I guess that's what you would call it. And I wanted to get with the program, and I had no qualms about going after the enemy. My regrets about Vietnam, number one, I lost 44 soldiers, which I can give you a name in case and what happened to them. I regret that tremendously. The other regret I've got is I didn't kill more of the enemy. And I say that truthfully. I don't have a PTSD problem or anything, any hang-ups about it. I killed them every chance I got, and if I could have, I'd have killed more of them, because that was our mission. And so you can say, well, you were a bloodthirsty guy. Did you get the enjoyment? I didn't enjoy it. I didn't feel good about it, but I didn't have hang-ups about it. And that's what I thought we were trained to do. And, of course, I worked with a couple of leaders in my second tour in particular who felt the same way I did, one of them being George Patton, who had been my mentor at West Point. And I say mentor, he took me under his wing when he was a captain and I was a cadet. And, of course, I went to work for him in combat, and it was a pleasure. And the next guy was Jimmy Leach, Colonel Jimmy Leach, who was a World War II hero. And those two guys were my bosses, and they saw my ability to bring fire on the enemy and kill the enemy, and they encouraged it every way they could. And a lot of people can't handle that. and they can't handle their soldiers being killed. They can't handle their soldiers bleeding to death in front of them. They can't handle all the horror that goes with war, which is nothing pretty about it. But we were trained to do that. In my mind, that was my job. Do it to the best of your ability.
Talk a little bit more about your relationship with Patton. Obviously, this is the son of the famed World War II general, and you are very complimentary in his book that he was every bit as good as a leader as his dad.
Yeah, I love the man, and he loved me like a son. Everybody says, you were the prodigal son. I says, yep. He called me a son of a bitch, but he says, you're my son of a bitch. He knew that I had the talents to fight, and he admired that, and he and I had a very special relationship. He was not afraid of anything that I ever saw. He would basically fight right beside me when necessary. In fact, I've just recently told a story about him joining a fight on the ground, and he was asked me to please not let anybody know that he was there on the ground helping me in an attack. And I wrote that up in a piece of paper, not in the book, about what he did when he didn't want anybody to know about it. But a leader by example never, ever flinched. I knew that I had his backing 100%. I knew that whatever I did, George Patton would back me up. And basically, he did that. And I had a number of occasions, some of which are covered in the book, where I took actions that weren't supposed to be taken. And when he found out about it, he says, I'll take care of it. For example, to bring in artillery fire and airstrikes in the Michelin plantation. The Michelin plantation, which is rubber for the Michelin tires, which I refused to ever buy ever again, they paid protection money from both for the Viet Cong and the NVA and everybody else to stay out of the plantations. Well, they hid under the trees. And so I flew by one day, and they made the mistake of shooting at me. That's the last thing you want to do. And so I flew around and brought artillery fire and airstrikes and everything else. Couldn't get clearance to do that. I did it anyway. And then when Patton finally was able to get a hold of me, he said, what happened? And I told him what happened. He says, good show. I'll take care of it. And he had to go up the tape and politically straighten that out because I'd knocked down rubber trees all over the damn place. By the time he got a hold of me, I'd brought in a half a dozen airstrikes, and I had the enemy pinned down on the ground, and then, of course, he brought two squadrons up, and we ran after him. And for about a week there, we killed people trying to get back over the border across Cambodia. George Patton was the kind of guy that says, yeah, you didn't get permission, but you sure, you've been excused of whatever you did. And he says, in fact, I think it's a great show.
Doc, we'll pause right there and take a short break. We're talking with Doc Bonson, retired Brigadier General, U.S. Army, very decorated Vietnam veteran. He is the author of American Warrior, and we'll be right back on Veterans Chronicles.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. We're joined by John Doc Bonson, retired Brigadier General, U.S. Army, highly decorated Vietnam veteran, subject of the book American Warrior by Wes Roberts. And Doc, in the few minutes we have in this segment, I want to get inside your mind as you approach all these different situations that happen in the book, these emergency situations where you're flying in, you're under fire from the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese Army, and each situation's a little bit different, whether it's extraction or you have a rallying area that the Viet Cong are at. And each time you have to make these split decisions about where to land, perhaps, if you're extracting, how quickly it has to be done, where to train fire, orders that you're giving. It's all happening so quickly, and I'm sure it's chaotic in the moment when it's hostile like that. How did your mind focus and prioritize going through those sorts of things?
Well, when you're taking fire, the first reaction is to figure out how you're going to return fire. And, of course, that to learn in the first tour, you return fire. And the first thing you do is mark the area, drop a grenade out the side of the helicopter, which we all learned to do real quick. Like, the door gunners and crew chiefs had a smoke grenade sitting in a canister with the pin pulled, and all they had to do was kick it out the door. So when you took fire, you immediately marked position. And then you brought whatever you could bring to bear on them. Sometimes it ended up being your guns, and sometimes that was the way you went after it. You did it quickly. And you basically brought fire on them as quick as you could. And my attitude was, if I could see where it was coming from, go right at them and just shoot hell out of them. And I learned that early on. Of course, you're taught not to overfly targets. Sometimes you had no alternative but fly right over the top of them. But and as quick as I could, I would bring artillery fire. As I told you earlier, I trained the forward observers in the 3rd Infantry Division in an aerial observer school to adjust artillery fire. So I was very, very proficient at it. I'd done probably several hundred missions that I had to supervise other people doing. So I got very good at it. And I knew where I was at most of the time. So I could do a real quick mark center sector type of fire mission and bring fire on them very, very quickly. And the other thing I did was bring air strikes on. When you had air sometime orbiting, you could bring them into the same thing, into the firefight. But and picking fire when you're in different situations, the first thing to do is return fire. And returning the fire as quickly as you can and then bringing more fire to bear. The one advantage we had over the Viet Cong and the NVA was our firepower. And we could always bring a preponderance of firepower on the enemy when necessary. And in fact, I remember any number of times where I'd adjust one battalion of artillery and the next thing I'd know I'd have 3 or 4 more in the same area dropping fire on a target. Well, with overwhelming firepower like that, you know, it changes the dynamics of the battlefield. And so artillery, airstrikes, and, of course, gunships. And my gunship experience, I had an air cavalry troop, and I learned how to use gunships, airstrikes, artillery all at the same time. And I'd been trained to do that, and I trained myself, of course, to do it. And basically, I felt comfortable doing that. And, of course, to do that, you got to be right in the middle of where the fire is taking place. And, of course, as I explained to people, yeah, we were hit several times. I mean, we were shot down a total of 13 times, one time, 3 times in one day. And my reaction to that was, get me another helicopter out here. And, of course, the guys came out and gave us another helicopter. And we immediately got jumped in the helicopter and went right back to the firefight. And when the third time we did it, we crashed back on the home pad. We had no hydraulics. They'd been shot out. And we crashed, and we got out of the damn thing and said, okay, let's go to the officers club. So we went over to the officers club and started drinking. I took my whole crew over there, and we started drinking because we'd survived three shoots down in one day. And so we got knee-walking drunk. And I'm sitting in front of the bar with all my troops around there telling stories, and I'm sitting there on my butt. And Patton heard about me getting shot down 3 times. And he came down to the bar to have a drink with me. And there I was. I couldn't get up. I said, sir, I'm the drunkest major you've ever seen. He said, by God, you are, but I'll drink to it. And he drank to it. And, of course, my crew couldn't move either. They're sitting there. They're near comatose because we were so happy. But, you know, you think about things like that when you get shot at, and you don't think about you're going to get shot down or hurt. And I say, when bullets start hitting your helicopter, You got 2 choices, you know. You can panic and get out of the area, or you can return fire. And I always thought returning fire is the way to do it. Of course, I have people around me get hit, but they seem to miss me on every occasion. I only got shot up pretty bad one time. But basically, taking fire from people, you react immediately to it. Now, I went in a big circle telling you about stories about that, but I watched rounds hit my chin bubble, hit over my head, behind my head, into my armor plate, and go through my crew chief right behind me. But, you know, it's one of those things where you're luck of the draw, and I'm probably the luckiest guy you ever met. Luckiest guy you have ever met, because generally people sitting around me got shot and I didn't get shot. My first sergeant flew with me one time when I was air captain commander, and he got shot in the butt, sitting right behind me in a jump seat. My sergeant major got shot and sitting in the same helicopter with me. He got shot in the leg, and both of them, you know, sitting near me, but I didn't get shot. They ended up getting shot. My sergeant major flew with me on a regular basis when I was a squadron commander. But my troop commanders, every one of my troop commanders was wounded at one time or another. And most of them weren't evacuated. Some of them were. But I had a replacement stream of new officers to take their place. But being wounded in our unit was quite common, especially with the ground unit.
Doc, we'll pause the story there and pick up when we come right back. We're talking with retired U.S. Army Brigadier General John Doc Bonson. I'm Greg Corumbus. This is Veterans Chronicles.
Listening to a podcast from the Radio America Network. Find more podcasts of your favorite shows at radioamerica.org. From Radio America and the American Veterans Center, this is Veterans Chronicles.
I'm Greg Corumbus. My guest this week is retired U.S. Army Brigadier General John Doc Bonson, highly decorated veteran from the Vietnam War. We've been talking about many of his different missions and what it's like to be in the firefight, especially in Vietnam. And Doc, one of the things that, of course, was most challenging as folks like me study it, and you, of course, lived it in Vietnam, is how easily the enemy could conceal himself given the terrain in Vietnam. So when you were on these missions and in these firefights, how did that play out?
Well, the mission of the Air Cavalry Troop, 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, was to find the bastards, okay? That was the mission of the Air Cavalry Troop. Our motto for the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment was find the bastards and pile on. You do that based on intelligence, number one, then from there, reconnaissance. And so our scouts went out looking for people. We looked for them. We looked for them, looked for the tracks through the darn dew in the morning, looked for the well-bitten places. We looked for all the indicators and, of course, find them. And once you find them, you had to make contact with them. And the purpose of making contact is so you could pile on. And a pile on involved larger units coming to join you and taking them under fire and killing them. And in a lot of cases, they would try very quickly to break contact. And, of course, the other half of making contact, you make contact with the enemy, and then you bring artillery fire on the opposite side of them as best you can. Then you have the gunships flying, and as they try to run out of the area, you can kill them with either artillery fire or gunships. And very quickly, you build up the firepower necessary to get them, attack them. And in the armored cavalry squadrons had troops in various incendiary places where you work in your area of operations, and they would very quickly come to reinforce you. So my rifle platoon would make the contacts. When the scouts made a contact, we'd put the rifle platoon on the ground, and they would move to contact. And once they got contact with the enemy, which I mean, you know, where they could shoot at them, and made contact, they maintained that contact till we'd get reinforcements there. Then we'd get reinforcements up and build the firepower up. And if we had tanks involved, and most often we did have tanks involved, all of our troops would have tanks attached to them, we would cut what I called a swath, where you run a tank around in a great big circle, knocking down all the trees all the way around the area where you had them isolated. And if you did that quickly enough, you'd have them where they couldn't get out without crossing that path where the tanks went. And the gunships are there to shoot them as they try to get across that area. And then you had them pinned into this big circle that you've done with the tanks. Then you line the troops up in a line and bring in down fire on top of them. Then you go through the bunker complex of the infantry people behind the armor vehicles, clearing the bunkers. And that was the technique we used. But as far as finding people, that was the mission, in my case, by the Arrow Scouts. And, of course, as you would expect, I lost a few Arrow Scouts, got killed in action, a lot of them wounded. But they had to make the contact over the thing. And, of course, there were a lot of those units in Vietnam, and that's the way you made contact. You ran them down once you caught them and once you could find out where they were. Now, there were other things you did. That wasn't the only thing you do. If you got an area and you pinned down where the bunkers were, and you couldn't get troops to that area, that was the place where you put B-52 strikes in. A B-52 strike is one click by three clicks. Now, use a template for it. And then when you got good intelligence, as we often did, where we knew where an enemy was located in a bunker complex, we'd put templates for B-52 strikes, and then bring the B-52 strikes over at night. And the first thing in the morning, as soon as the B-52 strike was over, in fact, as soon as they got out of the area, we'd fly into what we call a bomb damage assessment, with the Air Cavalry Troop flying around to see people staggering out of the damn bomb craters, the ones that survived. And then if you had enough of them there, you'd go in, of course, and try to get troops into the area, and you'd airlift them into the area. So a lot of different ways of going after the enemy. And it was nothing precise about it, nothing fixed. You had to be flexible, you had to be quick, and you had to bring firepower quickly, you had to make quick decisions, and then you had to have a boss like I had that would immediately reinforce you. And if you reinforce you, what the hell, whatever you had. And so some of the stories that we wrote about were those instances where we had good contacts and people showed a lot of bravery and showed a lot of capability to kill the enemy. And the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment took great pride in how fast we could bring forces to bear. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does.
I gave you probably more than you want to hear, but it's got to be quick. And it was in our case, it was quick. And if you're quick enough, you do it. The other thing you do, sometimes you have people disguised, and they used to ambush our columns over there and had a lot of ambushes. Well, my solution was that with what I call battle drill. And I had taught battle drill to my tank company. I taught battle drill to every unit I was in. And one of the battle drills was action right, which means everybody turns right and starts shooting to the right, or action left, which is everybody turns to the left and shoots to the left. And so if they made the mistake of ambushing one of my columns, the order was a very simple order. Where'd the ambush come from? It came from the right. It was turn right and immediately start firing and go towards them. Move the track straight towards them. No matter what it was, moving toward them. One of my troop commanders one time got ambushed on a march, a state troop commander, Captain Art West. And so he knew the order was action right. And so they were in the edge of a stream bed. So he did an action right, ran all of his tracks towards the stream bed and where the enemy was, ran over a bunch of them, and stuck every single track in the troop in a marshy area right by the stream. So I came by to visit him. I said, "What happened here?" He says, "Sir, I did an action right." He says, "And we just hit the mud." And he says, "But I think we killed a few of them." So we had to get all my VTRs up to pull the tracks out and muck them out of the muck, you know, and sometimes it took a while to get them all pulled out. And in pulling them out, underneath almost every track, there were dead enemy soldiers. Okay, they'd run over them, which is exactly what I want. You know, psychologically, they says, "You better watch that outfit." And you know something? They rarely ambushed my columns. They knew who we were. They heard our call signs. And they didn't spend a lot of time ambushed because they knew exactly what was going to happen. We were going to run over them. Now, those are some of the things you do when people try to hide from you. And sometimes you don't know where the hell they are, but you go after them, and you empty all your guns. Everybody's shooting at the same time. And I might add, we rehearsed that when I became a squadron commander, action right, action left. And sometimes I'd ride down a road and watch a column marching, and I'd go by to where the troop commander was. I'd circle the helicopter, and I'd give the action right or action left. And they would see me hanging out there, and then I'd give it over the radio at the same time. And basically, the troops learned to react to that. And so our particular squadron, and I guess a lot of other units did the same thing, had signals that meant turn, shoot, no questions asked. And that kind of stuff is important when you're in combat. So, you know, we were very effective. But in the case of West, when he stuck all of his tracks, I couldn't say anything except great things about what a great job they did.
There's one story I have to have you tell. And actually, I think it's somebody else who tells the story in the book, but it's the story of you land and you're in the middle of this hostile situation. All of a sudden, there's this flamethrower you take over. The person telling the story says, he probably hasn't even touched a flamethrower in years. He's in the middle of this hostile activity, and all of a sudden, he's clearing the area with this thing. Explain what happened there.
Well, we had people in bunkers, and I had a flamethrower as part of my headquarters. And I had ridden in with a lead troop there to attack this enemy force. In this case, I'd been shot down once. I got shot down, helicopter had the pedal shot up under my foot. And so we landed, and as quick as we could, I got on one of the tracks and rode to where the firefight was. And one of the vehicles they had there was a flamethrower. And the guy was hesitating to use a flamethrower in the bunker complex. And I says, "Hey." So I jumped on the thing, and I, of course, had experience on it, and drove right up to the bunker box and proceeded to burn all the bunkers I could hit with that flamethrower. And then we came up and cleared the bunkers. It's a dirty way to do business, and I won't describe what it's like, but it's, you know, it's one of these things. It's not pretty, but it's very effective, and we took no casualties from it. And, of course, my regimental commander is up above watching me do this. And he came away, he says, "I can't believe the guy." Well, it wasn't that big a deal. It's just baked the thing up there, and here's the bunkers, and put the flame in there. And, of course, that thing puts a napalm right in the middle of the bunkers. And we cleared the bunker complex. Didn't sink a single casualty, which is important in a firefight. We didn't sink a single casualty, and we killed a lot of the enemy that day. And that flamethrower was the main weapon. Now, we had other weapons beside that, you know, the tracks, the Sheridans, who have the canister rounds, and we had our tanks, I think, were in there at the same time. They have the flechettes in the Sheridans. We had the canister in the tanks, and of course, they had all the machine guns and everything else shooting. But the flamethrower is one that set the tone for it. And a lot of guys didn't want to use the flamethrower, but I thought it's very, very effective.
In addition to the mission that you're on, and that was clearly the most important thing to you, being awarded these very prestigious awards, what does that mean to you?
Well, it's recognition by your fellow soldiers. I'll just give an example. The first two decorations I got were two Bronze Star with V devices. This is the second tour. First tour, Marine Corps put us in for decoration. Marine Corps, who I'd supported and never thought a thing about what we did, we broke an ambush on a Marine column and with the gunships. And the next thing I knew, I was told I was to meet formation. You're being decorated with a Silver Star, which was early on in the war, and not very many people got Silver Stars. But the Marine Corps put me in for a Silver Star. I knew nothing about it at all. I thought it was a routine action. And it wasn't a routine action to them. And they put the decoration in, got approved, it came down. Next thing I know, in formation, my battalion commander is pinning the Silver Star on me. That's the way it happened. The second two decorations I got were Bronze Star with V devices. And I, again, firefights where I'm on the ground fighting, and two of my classmates are in the regiment, both in the staff, and they recommended the decoration. I knew nothing about that. I showed up at formation one day, and Patton says, "You're being decorated today," and they published the orders, and they published the orders, and it told the story about this thing that I'd forgotten about, that one of my classmates wrote up and recommended for the Bronze Star. And so that was kind of interesting. And at the same time, said, "We got another one here." Somebody else, another one of the classmates, had written one up and on some other action. And I got two decorations in the same time with George Patton with these two Bronze Stars that I knew nothing about. The other decorations and the different people who put me in for them, I didn't know was taking place. Now, in the case of Distinguished Service Cross, which is the number two decoration, I didn't realize this till Patton told me. I was recommended for it three times, and I was awarded one of them. Other two were downgraded to Silver Stars. I only knew about that after the fact. But basically, those decorations in most cases were a surprise. The Distinguished Flying Cross, again, Patton was the prime mover, and I had Colonel Leach. My regimental commander says, "I want him decorated," and here's what he did. And, of course, I think they embellished in some cases some of the stuff in the awards, but I remembered the actions, per se, and I thought, hey, you know, soldiers take care of the soldiers. And, of course, I tried to do the same thing for all the men under my command. For example, my co-pilot, who flew with me on a daily basis when I was Air Corps Group Commander, received seven Distinguished Flying Crosses, seven of them. And you say, well, why did he receive seven Distinguished Flying Crosses? Well, he was flying with me normally, and he would land and drop me off on the ground where I could be where the people were on the ground to do the fight. And he'd stay in the air and circle the area as my radio contact. And get shot full of holes or one thing or another, or do whatever's required. He was a warrant officer, and he was a great warrant officer. And God rest his soul, he died last year of cancer. But Mike Bates was his name, and Mike Bates was an absolutely outstanding soldier. But, you know, he never flinched when he's flying around, whether he got shot, whatever. But he really did deserve seven distinctions. I might add, he also got two Silver Stars, Bronze Stars, what have you, very well decorated. And he later on was a gunship pilot. He was trained as a gunship pilot. Those kind of people around you, and you see that they're willing to fight and they're going to stick with you. You take care of those guys. And most of my pilots that fought on a regular basis, I tried to make sure they got decorated. And I had an XO. His mission in life when I walked back was to take my 3x5 card with a guy's name on there with a little sketch of what happened, put this into a recommendation for an award, and here's who's eyewitnesses. Go get these guys to write your statement up for eyewitnesses. Go talk to them. And so that's the way we did it. But those above me, it just made you feel good to think that somebody was watching what was going on and recommended you for an award. Yeah, you're very, very proud of it. But, you know, would you go out and do it again? Hell no. You did what you're supposed to do. And my feeling is doing what I was good at doing, and I did it. And it never occurred to me I was going to be decorated for almost every action. Colonel Leach was over when I did the flamethrower thing. Well, you know, I didn't see anything different, but I was madder than hell. They'd shot me down. A round hit in the bottom of the thing and took the pedal out of my foot. Didn't hurt me, but I couldn't fly the thing. The other guy says, sir, you giving any penalties? That's right, I don't. Now you take over and land us. We'll get another helicopter. Well, I couldn't get another helicopter right then. I said, well, I'll just get on the ground. I'll go to where the action is. Well, Leach watched all that, and he was impressed. And I never thought anything about it. So when I found out he'd recommended me for award, I was flabbergasted because I thought it was a routine action. He thought it was spectacular. That's the difference.
You certainly put in your share of recommendations for others once you rose up the chain, correct?
You know, you probably know, we just had a troop of the 11th Armored Cavalry recognized with the President's Unit Citation for actions in 1970. And they went to the White House, and the President presented the President's Citation. Can you imagine how great those soldiers felt all these many years getting recognized with a unit award? The President's Unit Citation, of course, is equivalent to the Distinguished Service Cross for the whole unit. We worked hard to get those guys recognized, and we should have done more. If I have one other regret about Vietnam, I wish I'd have decorated more soldiers because they deserve everything they got, and they deserve more. We've not given enough recognition to a lot of our veterans in the Vietnam War like we should have. We should have been more generous. And the one thing I might add to this, which is my personal opinion, I think they've done a poor job of decorating soldiers in our current war, the Iraqi War and the Afghanistan War. If you look at the decorations that have been given for these wars, they've been very, very chintzy in passing out awards. And I think that's wrong. I throw that out because I think if you look right now, we've not done what we should have done for our volunteer army that's fighting two very unpopular wars.
We'll be right back for our final segment on Veterans Chronicles with retired U.S. Army Brigadier General Doc Bonson.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
I'm Greg Corumbus. This is Veterans Chronicles. My guest this hour is retired U.S. Army Brigadier General John Doc Bonson. He is a very highly decorated Vietnam veteran. He is the subject of the book American Warrior by Wes Roberts. And in our last few minutes here, Doc, so many different stories, but the one I want you to recap is the one you just told me during the break, and that's how you led a charge without a weapon.
when you think about it, you'll think, how dumb could he be? But at the time, I did what I thought I was supposed to do. We had a contact in the evening before, and this Vietnamese platoon, a reconnaissance platoon, had been ambushed. And so we went out the next morning to find these guys that ambushed them. And in the process, as we flew by, I saw a bomb carrier there, and there's a dead soldier laying on the side of the thing there, weapon laying there, and I said, okay. So I pulled around a road, went right by this thing, and it's out in the middle of a fairly open field in War Zone D. And so I says, land, I'll take a look at it. So at that time, this is fairly early on in my tour as an aircraft troop commander, so I says, Mike, just sit here and hold the helicopter. I jumped out of the seat, ran over, and I was going to go over and get the papers and the weapon out of this guy in the bomb crater. Well, as I walked over there, they opened fire on us, and of course, I dove in the bomb crater as quick as I could, and Mike pulled pitch and left me, and just started circling, yelling for help. Well, we had a rifle platoon about a half a mile away, and so they double-timed as fast as they could down there to come join me. And he guided them into him, and he's circling. He realized he left me there on the damn ground, and of course I had not taken my weapon. I didn't have my pistol with me, and my weapon was hanging right there. And usually I put my LBE on, took my M16 sack of grenades on, and jumped out with my sack of grenades and my LBE and my M16. Well, I didn't do it, and dumber than hell when I did it. And jumped out and jumped in there. And of course, my rifle platoon got there very, very quickly. And they all piled in the bomb crater with me. Of course, they're still shooting overhead, nobody taking a hit. And so I said, oh, those sons of And I got on the radio there, and Patton flew out. And, in fact, the S3 was Jim Dozier, West Point classmate. And, of course, the S2, Andy O'Meara, was there. And they all watched this action. And watched me develop the thing. And Patton said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to make an attack on them. I said, but I'm going to bring my gunships in first. So I called my red team leader, and I says, okay, red 6, come right over the top of the bomb crater, which you can see, and just shoot the hell out of the air right in front of us. As I think they're located 20, 30 yards out in front of us, as best I can tell, because I'm hunkered down. And he did exactly what I told him to do. And, of course, Mike Bates is flying my helicopter. He's watching. He says, they're about 20 feet in front of you there. I can see the fire coming out of there. I says, good, we'll take them out. And so basically I got the gunships, and as soon as the gunship came over, he shot the heck out of there with a Gatling gun, a minigun, and really shot it up good. And, of course, the brass casings have fallen on top of us right there. That's how close he was. And went right over the top. And as soon as he pulled off, he says, okay, everybody on your feet, let's go. And let's go after him. And we jumped up, and everybody got out of the bomb crater, scrambled up there. And, of course, the enemy started running. And I realized when I jumped out of the bomb crater, I didn't have a weapon. So I said, shoot that son of a bitch. I'm pointing at everybody there. And, of course, my guys are shooting up the area. They're crack shots. This is my rifle platoon, which is very, very special outfit. And, of course, we ran them down. Then they got up and started running. And we ran them down. And they ran down 10 prisoners real quick, like ran them and grabbed them. And the rest of them we killed. And it was a good action. And I didn't take a scratch. And, of course, very shortly thereafter, Patton lands. He says, what the hell is that all about? And he says, that's the damnedest thing I've ever seen in my life. He didn't know I didn't have a weapon, so I didn't tell him. And O'Meara had seen it. And they went back and says, hey. And Patton says, put him in for Distinguished Service Cross. That's the bravest thing I've ever seen. What he didn't realize is one of the dumbest things he'd ever seen. But he didn't realize that at the time. And O'Meara went back, and they wrote me up a Distinguished Service Cross, which ended up being the first Oakley Clefto Silver Star. It wasn't approved as a Distinguished Service Cross. And I didn't realize, but I knew that Andy O'Meara wrote it up. And, of course, Jim Dozier, my classmate, was a witness to it. And Patton, of course, signed the decoration. But basically, later on, it came out that I didn't have a weapon, and he had never heard that story. And he says, you made an attack without a weapon. I says, I thought it was the right thing to do at the time, albeit very, very dumb if you think about it. But sometimes you do things in the heat of passion or the heat of fight or whatever it is that you don't think about till after the fact. But I survived it. My soldiers, none of my soldiers got hit, and we were successful. So that's in the final criteria. That's what you want to have, is kill the enemy and don't get anybody hurt. And I was honored to be given a Silver Star for it. I thought that was very generous.
Sometimes bravery stems from decisions that aren't necessarily thought through.
That's a classic example, not a very dumb act, but it was, you know, they saw it as being very brave.
Accomplished your goals at the same time. Doc, it has been an absolute honor to have you with us today. Your service to this country is commendable on so many levels. We thank you for that, and thank you for sharing it with us today.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much for inviting me. I appreciate that.
Retired U.S. Army Brigadier General John Doc Bonson, highly decorated Vietnam veteran. He is the subject of the book American Warrior by Wes Roberts. I'm Greg Corumbus, and this has been Veterans Chronicles.